You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Kelly.
Good morning.
I think everybody out there knows what that means.
You are tuned in to the Community Living Show on the NCRA radio stations across Canada and across British Columbia. Of course, I'm Kelly Reburn. Along with me is Michael Ruben Cloggs. Well, it's supposed to be Sunday, but happy... It's going to be Victoria Day anyways for tomorrow. Anyways, happy Victoria Day.
Why don't we just say happy Victoria Day?
Yeah, so there we go.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah, so I wasn't really able to find a guest, but
yeah,
but there are a group of disabilities that we don't talk about much.
No, not mostly.
Yeah. One is of course hearing.
Yeah.
Which I should probably round up more people that I know of around that particular disability. The other one is brain damage.
Yes. A lot of, it depends on if you're in a car accident or if you're just born naturally with the brain damage, right?
Yeah.
Some people have that kind of an issue.
In one of the good friends of the show, Cheryl Young, when we did the walk, of course, she was run over by the RV, and her husband Nigel, who was actually driving the RV, he still has a lot to deal with behind that. It's another disability with the emotional PTSD thing. We've only touched on a couple times on that, but Cheryl now has a brain injury, and which is actually going to leave some permanent damage.
Of course.
So I can't get in too far with it because she's asked me because of legal issues and things like that, because it's still being debated with ICBC and the whole claim.
Mm-hmm.
So that's as far as I can actually go and say.
Right, okay.
What I did find was, because I'm one of those super geeks, and I listen to on YouTube a lot of these kind of out there lectures.
Right.
One would be the Perimeter Institute, and the other one is the Royal Institute. One is here in Canada, I'm going to just say it's in Ontario. The Perimeter Institute's in Ontario. And the Royal Institute was actually started by Michael Faraday in England when he was doing a lot of his electrical experiments. This lady, Eleanor McGuire, actually Dr. Eleanor McGuire, has a lecture on the neuroscience behind memory.
Okay.
And what parts of the brain and everything kind of start to affect
it. So it's kind of like the brain doctor.
Yeah, she's a brain doctor. Yeah.
Okay.
And I thought that it's some subjects that we don't really touch on, and I thought maybe, well, let's talk about them.
Yeah, of course.
So with that, I'm actually going to play as much as we can of this lecture.
Okay.
With breaks and everything else going for us.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough.
About the neuroscience behind memory. So,
okay.
So this is from recorded, it was first published in 2014. So we're going to actually go back and we're going to look for even more neuroscience.
Great.
Information as we can And try to get as many of these doctors on our show as we can.
We really appreciate that kind of a topic for our brain damage and stuff.
Yeah. So, without any further ado, why don't we just get into this particular lecture from the Royal Institute?
Sure.
Many august speakers have stood in this theatre over the years, contemplating the nature of the universe, whether time travel is possible, could we build a time machine? As a nation, we adore our science fiction time lords and the Star Trekkers who can transport themselves at the flick of a switch through space onto alien worlds. But the reality is that we already have a device that can do all of those things and more. A teleportation machine that can effortlessly transport us to different times and different places. I'm talking, of course, about the brain, the universe within. In this discourse, I'm going to consider why and how the brain allows us to accomplish these wondrous feats. And the answers, in fact, come from an understanding of memory. We're endlessly fascinated by memory. We desire to improve it. We fear its loss. As this quote illustrates quite nicely, I think, you have to begin to lose your memory, if only in bits and pieces, to realize that memory is what makes our lives. Life without memory is no life at all. Our memory is our coherence, our reason, our feeling, even our action. Without it, we are nothing. But the importance of memory goes beyond the individual and their personal autobiography. We share memories, and in many ways, memories are the glue that holds society together. They're the basis of culture. If you think about it, if we didn't have memory, we would constantly keep reinventing the wheel, and there'd be an awful lot of Groundhog Days. Well, I'm going to show you that memory is not just one thing. It also doesn't occur in a vacuum. It's not even that accurate, and in fact, it's not really about the past. Scurrilous notions, you might think. But I'll argue that these features are, in fact, the key to our ability to mentally travel through space and time. So let me illustrate. There are many different types of memory. It's not a unitary phenomenon. So we have short-term memory, and this is for information that we need to hold on to or rehearse for immediate use. Now, the example I've given here is phone numbers, but I realise now, actually, that in a sort of perverse reversal, that in fact our phones have actually become our short-term memories. But we also have long-term memories, and one sort of long-term memory is skills or habits. So we learn to ride a bicycle and then it becomes automatic. We can do it effortlessly, probably for life. And then there are these other types of memories, the rich personal memories that punctuate our lives. And these are known as episodic or autobiographical memories. Now we know there are these different types of memories because damage to different parts of the brain impact selectively on these memory types. So, for example, in a classic amnesia, which I'll talk more about later, patients cannot form new memories, and they often lose the memories of their past experiences. But despite what the Hollywood movies would have us believe, they do remember who they are, they do remember who their families are, and they remember facts about the world. It's this selective loss of autobiographical memories that they have. By contrast, there's a certain type of dementia where the first thing that's compromised is this sort of memory, the memory for facts about the world, concepts, their vocabulary, their naming ability. But their autobiographical memories, at least in the early stages of the disease, is intact. So memory comes in different forms, supported by different brain areas, and of course they all interact. Now another important feature of memory is illustrated by an experiment from over 40 years ago, but it still makes the point in a very compelling way. Now, the experiment would take too long to do here, but let me just give you a sort of sense of it. So it involved text such as this. And subjects had to memorize this text. So let me read quickly through it. If the balloons popped, the sound would not be able to carry, since everything would be away from the correct floor. A closed window would also prevent the sound from carrying, since most buildings tend to be well insulated. Since the whole operation depends on a steady flow of electricity, a break in the middle of the wire would also cause problems. Of course, the fellow could shout, but the human voice is not loud enough to carry that far. An additional problem is that a string could break on the instrument, then there could be no accompaniment to the message. It's clear that the best situation would involve less distance, and then there would be fewer potential problems. With face-to-face contact, the least number of things could go wrong. So there was the subject, faced with this piece of text, had to memorize it. Tricky, I think you'll agree, because it doesn't really make much sense. Now, another group of subjects very briefly saw a scene before they were required to read and memorize the text. They saw this scene, and then they memorized the text. And the subject who saw the scene very briefly did much better on the memory test than those who weren't exposed to the scene. So memory works better if it occurs in a context. If we can draw upon our prior knowledge about how the world works and link the incoming information with what we already know. Now, testing memory also consistently reveals something else of importance. Now, I would be failing in my duties as a memory researcher if I didn't take the opportunity to test your memories. Okay, so let's get down to business. You're going to see a countdown of 3, 2, 1. Then you're going to see a picture flashed on the screen very briefly, so you've got to pay attention. There'll be a brief visual mask, and then you'll see a second picture. And all you have to do is say whether the second picture is the same view as in the first picture, whether it's closer up or further away. Okay, so I believe you have some voting pads. So if we could have a look at the voting pad options. There we go. So you're going to press button A if you think the second picture is closer up. You're going to press button B if you think it's the same. And you're going to press button C if you think it's further away. Okay, don't worry, we'll remind you again before you have to make your decision. And that's not even the memory test. Okay, so if we could go back to the laptop now. Right. So are you ready? It's going to be really quick, I'm not joking, okay? Right, if we could have the options up again, please. Now, was the second picture closer up, the same, or further away? Blink and you miss it. So you should go with your gut instinct on this now. Don't overthink it. Overthinking is bad. We'll just let everybody finish their voting. Have a guess if you're not sure. A, B, C. What do we think? All done? Everybody finished? Good. Okay, let's have a look at the results, if we may. Okay, so we see that a lot of you thought that it was closer up. And we see that some of you thought it was the same, and a smaller number thought that it was further away. Okay, we're going to do another one. So anyone who missed it, press your buttons. Right, let's go back to the laptop, if we may. Right, okay, ready? Don't blink, you'll miss it. Here we go. Right, if we could have the options up again. A, closer up. B, the same. C, further away. Okay, let's see what we've got. Okay, very similar. Somebody's invalid, but we won't go into that. There's always one. So you can see we're actually quite consistent across the two tests. We've got around the 60% mark of people thinking that it was closer up, and we have some people thinking it's the same, and a few, much fewer.
You're listening to CITR 101.9.
Okay, we had some technical difficulties here. Not sure why, but my computer decided to bail on the interview or the lecture. So let's see if we can get back to where we were.
Popped, the sound would not be able to carry, since everything would be away from the correct floor. A closed window would also prevent the sound from carrying, since most buildings tend to be well insulated. Since the whole operation depends on a steady flow of electricity, a break in the middle of the wire would also cause problems. Of course, the fellow could shout, but the human voice is not loud enough to carry that far. An additional problem is that a string could break on the instrument, then there could be no accompaniment to the message. It's clear that the best situation would involve less distance, and then there would be fewer potential problems. With face-to-face contact, the least number of things could go wrong. So there was the subject, faced with this piece of text, had to memorize it. Tricky, I think you'll agree, because it doesn't really make much sense. Now, another group of subjects very briefly saw a scene before they were required to read and memorize the text. They saw this scene, and then they memorized the text. And the subject who saw the scene very briefly did much better on the memory test than those who weren't exposed to the scene. So memory works better if it occurs in a context. If we can draw upon our prior knowledge about how the world works and link the incoming information with what we already know. Now, testing memory also consistently reveals something else of importance. Now, I would be failing in my duties as a memory researcher if I didn't take the opportunity to test your memories. Okay, so let's get down to business. You're going to see a countdown of 3, 2, 1. Then you're going to see a picture flashed on the screen very briefly, so you've got to pay attention. There'll be a brief visual mask, and then you'll see a second picture. And all you have to do is say whether the second picture is the same view as in the first picture, whether it's closer up or further away. Okay. So I believe you have some voting pads. So if we could have a look at the voting pad options. There we go. So you're going to press button A if you think the second picture is closer up. You're going to press button B if you think it's the same. And you're going to press button C if you think it's further away. Okay. Don't worry, we'll remind you again before you have to make your decision. And that's not even the memory test. Okay, so if we could go back to the laptop now. Right. So are you ready? It's going to be really quick, I'm not joking. Okay? Right, if we could have the options up again, please. Now, was the second picture closer up, the same, or further away? Blink and you miss it. So you should go with your gut instinct on this now. Don't overthink it. Overthinking is bad. We'll just let everybody finish their voting. Have a guess if you're not sure. A, B, C. What do we think?
Okay, so pardon for the technical difficulties. Sometimes computers just want to crap out on us. So with that, you're listening to Community Living Radio, and we're here at CITR here on UBC campus, Vancouver, at 101.9 FM. And we'll be back with the lecture and the show after a couple messages. Thank you.
When you join Balloon Club, we guarantee that you will be able to make a balloon poodle within the first day.
Here at the UBC Ant Club, we just like to talk about ants and compare ant farms. It's really cool.
Paperclip Club is all about, well, paperclips mostly.
At Blah Club, you can blah blah, blah 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 blah.
Explosion!
There's only one club worth joining at UBC, and that's CITR 101.9 FM. We got free tickets to shows, whirly pops, professional help in all types of audio engineering, passes to festivals, crazy parties, live band swag, all types of crazy people. Our programming manager rides a motorcycle. There's freestyle rapping, Nardwar the Human Serviette, the vinyl and record libraries, Discorder magazine, free studio recording, and it sure beats the hell out of Paperclip Club, which is a thing that I just made up because I work at
CITR.
So come check us out on the floor of the Student Union Building. We got all types of crazy shit for you to do. Or check us out online at www.citr.ca.
I faced it. I have Alzheimer's disease.
My diagnosis has let me get on with my life my way.
The more we learned about my grandfather's dementia, the more we could face the future and make plans.
My husband, Tom, and I spoke to our doctor right away.
I have Alzheimer's, but it doesn't have me.
I faced it.
So can you.
For more information about early diagnosis, visit alzheimer.ca.
Okay, we're going to get back to the lecture.
And you are tuned in to the Community Living Show.
Thank you very much, Kelly.
You're welcome.
All right.
Typically use mnemonics or strategies, and they practice and they practice, so it's very effortful. I'm talking instead about people like this. I'm 34 years old. I can take a date between 1974 and today, and tell you what day it falls on, what I was doing that day, and if anything of great importance occurred on that day. I can describe that to you as well. I do not look at calendars beforehand. I do not read 24 years of my journals either. Whenever I see a date flash on the television or anywhere else for that matter, I automatically go back to that day and remember where I was, what I was doing, what day it fell on, and on and on and on and on. It is non-stop, uncontrollable, and totally exhausting. Most people have called it a gift, but I call it a burden. I run my entire life through my head every day, and it drives me crazy. So you can appreciate that remembering absolutely everything is not desirable, and we should rejoice in our normal forgetting, because believe me, it is a good thing. So we've established that there are different types of memory, that memory is designed to work in the context of our existing knowledge, that memory is not perfect, that there are errors. And the question we need to ask is, why is memory like this? Well, it has to do with the other scurrilous claim I made earlier, which was that memory is not really about the past. And to explore this, we need to turn to the brain. Here's the brain in all its glory, thanks to the wonders of magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI. And you can see here the sorts of detail and views we can get of the brain. Here we're face on, here we're side on, here we're looking down through the top of the head. We can see the grey matter, the white matter. We can appreciate the complexity of the connections between brain areas. Now, the formal study of the brain basis of memory really took off in the 1950s with this patient, H.M. or Henry Mollison. Now, poor H.M. suffered from intractable epilepsy, and in order to alleviate his seizures, both of his temporal lobes were removed. And you can see the sort of black areas here is where his temporal lobes used to be. Now, the surgery did indeed reduce his seizure frequency, but it had the unintended and devastating side effect of making him densely amnesic. So after the surgery, he couldn't form any new memories. He lost much of his past. But he did retain factual knowledge about the world. His short-term memory appeared to be fine. His general intellect was fine, as were his social skills. So he appeared to have this selective loss of his autobiographical or episodic memory. So contrast this with the description we read earlier of the patient with superior autobiographical memory. So HM is asked, what do you do on a typical day? And he says, see, that's tough. Well, I don't remember things. Do you know what you did yesterday? No, I don't. How about this morning? I don't even remember that. Could you tell me what you had for lunch today? I don't know. To tell you the truth, I don't know. I'm not. What do you think you'll do tomorrow? Whatever is beneficial. Now, at the time, his deficit was linked to one particular part of the temporal lobe. And that part of the temporal lobe is the hippocampus, which you can see here, deep in the temporal lobes there in red, circled in red here in this little cartoon, and circled on the three views of the MRI scan. And it's called the hippocampus because an early anatomist likened it to a seahorse. This is a slightly icky picture of a hippocampus taken out of a human brain, but to illustrate that it does look quite like a seahorse or hippocampus. Now, in fact, you can hopefully see that HM's surgery, in fact, took away a lot more than his hippocampus. So his memory problems cannot really be linked with certainty to the hippocampus. However, in subsequent decades, we have located patients who appear to have selective damage of just the hippocampus on both sides, as far as our current anatomical imaging can tell us. And they have very similar profiles in terms of their memory preservation and impairment as HM. And of course, studies of healthy subjects where we infer neural activity from blood flow on functional MRI or fMRI scans confirm the engagement of the hippocampus along with other brain areas when people recall their past experiences. So the hippocampus is necessary for helping us to recall our autobiographical memories, those personal memories that make our lives. But in a different domain, the hippocampus was also under scrutiny. Because in the 1970s, physiologists recording from single neurons in the rat hippocampus made a startling discovery. They found that there were cells that seemed to respond to specific places in the environment. And this is irrespective of where the rat was looking. And these place cells, as they came to be known, seemed to in some way embody the memory for that particular place. Now, on the right here, we're looking down at a round arena, and you can see a little cartoon rat there. And what I'm going to play now is a movie. And what you'll see is you'll see the rat moving around this arena. And what you'll hear is the sound of an actual place cell firing. And you'll see that this place cell likes one particular part of the environment. So, you can see he's looking all over the place, even when he's in the northwest of the arena. But that place cell, he's loving the northwest. Now the rat's going to speed up a bit. I just speeded it up just to save time. He's not manic or anything, so. But you can see just how specific it is. So even though the rat's going all over the place, it's really focused on this part of the environment. And then you, of course, have place cells that cover all different parts of the environment, thus appearing to map the spatial locations within that environment. So here we have a situation where the rat hippocampus, at any rate, seems to be fundamentally involved with processing space. Now, since this discovery, many studies have examined spatial memory in humans. Now, for example, in my lab, we took advantage of this commercially available video game. Some of you might know. It's called The Getaway. It's made by Sony. And they set this video game in central London, and you could navigate within it. And at the time, it was a pretty faithful simulation of London, including most of the roads and the shops and the buildings. So we had subjects find their way around London in this virtual environment while their brains are being scanned. So obviously, we can't really look at navigation normally if people have their heads fixed in a brain scanner. They're not going anywhere. But this way, we could use this virtual navigation as a proxy for real navigation. So I'm now going to show you a movie of the results of one of our experiments. And what we were able to do was we were able to relate the thoughts that people were having during navigation with the brain activity on the fMRI scans. So on the bottom left, you're going to see where the person was actually navigating. This is one of the subjects navigating. Here's a little sort of overview to show you where they're going to go. You'll see the thoughts they were having appearing in thought bubbles up here, and then you'll see the fMRI activity that was occurring at the time of those thoughts. Right. Now, the hippocampus comes on very quickly at the start, so you'll have to be quick to see it, because it's involved when you plan and visualize your route when you're about to start. Okay, so there's, say, we used to go to Peter Street. So there's the hippocampus, so he's gone off now. So now we're moving down Shaftesbury Avenue. Decided to change routes, so some of the frontal areas come on. Ah, now there's a blockage. He's got to take a different route. So he's coasting along. He's planning. His cerebellum comes on. He's got to take this corner carefully. Now you'll see, look at all the swathes of visual cortex coming on, because he's thinking, God, these shops look colourful. Then he's thinking, yeah, I should see this. Oh, there it is, good. And then a little bit of road rage just to end with there. So you can see that virtual navigation, and we believe actual navigation, activates many brain areas, but the hippocampus in particular seems to come on when you're engaged in visually planning your route. Now, we also used this virtual London in another study. We had the chance to test this patient, patient TT. He's an extremely rare patient, and he had damage primarily restricted to his two hippocampi. So you can sort of see the holes where his hippocampi should be. And naturally, he was densely amnesic as a consequence. Crucially, before his illness, he had been a licensed London taxi driver for 40 years. So the question we were able to pose was, how would his hippocampal damage affect this long-standing navigation skill and his knowledge of the spatial layout of London? So here I'm just showing an example trial. And what these subjects had to do, including TT, was get from St. Paul's Cathedral to the Bank of England. Easy peasy if you're a cab driver. And indeed, the 10 control taxi drivers who were the same age and the same level of experience as TT, look at that, they all took the same direct route, no errors whatsoever. Now in black we see the route taken by TT, and you can see that he's going all around the houses. He cannot get there, and in fact he doesn't get there. And this was the same on trial after trial. So they were virtually navigating around London, but he couldn't get there. And the astute amongst you might have realised something about his navigation. In fact, he's using just the A roads, the big old A roads, and he cannot navigate on the smaller roads. So he seems to have lost the finer detail of the smaller routes, and he couldn't visualise them in his route planning. Now, of course, we had already shown that the back part of the hippocampus, the posterior hippocampus, was larger in London taxi drivers than in non-taxi drivers, including London bus drivers. And more recently, we did a longitudinal study where we took trainees who were learning the knowledge, thanks to the cooperation of the Public Carriage Office. And so we study them before they started learning the layout of London, and then we got them to come back when they'd qualified. Now, interestingly, about 50% qualified and 50% failed to qualify, and we also had a control group. In those who qualified, we saw increased volume in the posterior part of their hippocampus at time two, 3.5 years later, compared to time one. And in those who didn't qualify, we didn't see any changes. So these sorts of studies demonstrate the plasticity of the adult human brain in response to environmental stimulation. So the brain is not fixed. We can change it by what we do. But it also underlines the relationship between the human hippocampus and space. Okay, so here we have this brain structure then, the hippocampus, that doesn't work alone. It's part of these larger brain networks concerned with memory, but it nevertheless appears to be particularly critical for autobiographical memories, but also for spatial navigation. And we see devastating effects on these cognitive functions when the two hippocampi are compromised. And the hippocampus, it turns out, is vulnerable to a whole range of common pathologies, strokes, epilepsy, dementia, including Alzheimer's disease, loss of oxygen to the brain or anoxia, and certain types of brain infection. So what is the hippocampus doing that makes it so important for recalling the past and navigation? Two seemingly disparate cognitive functions. Well, in the last...
Okay, we're going to break it there. But Kelly, that's when they're talking about the hippocampus, there's like two of them, and it's like, in comparison to the rest of the brain, it's like you're talking like it's maybe 1% of the weight of the brain.
Yes.
Like, it's pretty amazing, right? The how much control it has.
And also on that segment, you have files and files and files of compartments of your brain dealing with the virtual reality of the car segment on that part.
Yeah. So it's pretty interesting. Her research is pretty interesting. Especially dealing with memory loss, so...
Even if you're multitasking.
Yes, even if you're multitasking. So, yeah, it's wildly crazy that who would have thought that just this little piece of brain does so much for how we actually do so much in our daily lives.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the one guy, he couldn't remember what he had for lunch.
No. Because that's what I heard, yeah. Or dinner or whatever he had.
So, anyway.
So, yeah.
So, let's get off to a couple messages here.
Yep.
And
we'll be right back. Yep.
You're listening to Community Living Radio here on CITR of UBC Vancouver, 101.9 FM.
Newspapers and magazines did you regularly read to stay informed and to understand the
I've
world?
Read most of them, again, with a great appreciation for the press, for the media.
But like, what ones specifically?
All of them.
Want to know more than Sarah Palin? Join CITR's Current Affairs Coordinator, Alex DeBoer, every Tuesday from 4 to 5 p.m. in room 2514 in the AMS Nest to learn best practices for covering local current affairs topics for radio. The weekly training sessions will cover writing for radio, determining newsworthiness, media ethics, interviewing, writing balanced stories, and more.
Either you've been troubled, you've been broke, you've been hungry, no job, no money. The one you loved and deserted you, that makes you blue.
Got the blues? Just want to hear some blues? Tune in every Saturday afternoon from 3 to 5 for Code Blue. Right here on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver, www.citr.ca. Code Blue.
He feels about it. Blues ain't nothing but a man, good man feeling bad, no how. That's all that is.
You're tuned into the Community Living Show on the National Campus and Radio Association Networks. And just to make a note that last Thursday, we had our Global Accessibility National Awareness Day, and we had about five or six stations throughout the NCRA radio stations. Thank you very much for tuning in to the marathon. I know CITR did its bit, and then, of course, we did it for 2 hours for it on Co-op Radio, and so on and so on. We thank you very much for tuning in. Hopefully, we'll have our fifth annual next year.
Yeah, and... What I would like people to do is to either call in and ask for Brian McKinnon and say, "Hey, Brian, we want more of the Global Accessibility Day. Can we possibly next year have it play all day?" If you guys could do that, what's the office phone number again, Kelly? Do you remember?
604-684-8494.
Yeah, and ask for Brian McKinnon and say, "Hey, Brian, we want a whole day of global accessibility."
Yeah, and which, of course, it started from 10 o'clock this morning, that morning on Pacific time, till about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Yeah. So.
And I bet you he'll respond and give it to us. What do you think? Yeah,
I hope so. I know the other stations did it, so
you
never know.
Yeah,
this will be the fifth one next year, so keep in mind it's the third Thursday of May of each year. So
yeah, okay, so let's get back to the lecture.
Yes, and you're tuning to me to the Community Living Show.
Number of years we've begun to unravel this somewhat, and once again the insights come from studying patients with selective damage to the two hippocampi. And as you would expect, these patients were amnesic, they couldn't find their way around. But this time we asked them a different question. We asked them to imagine an experience that might happen to them in the future. So not the past. We know they can't do the past. But what about the future? They couldn't do it. So then we said, well, so these patients can't recall the past. They can't imagine the future. They're stuck in the present. They cannot travel through time, mentally speaking. Well, we then asked them just to imagine a simple scene, so not one that was set in the past or the future. And they couldn't do that either. Now, they could imagine single objects, so it wasn't just a problem with the basic ability to imagine. They could imagine single objects in their mind's eye, but they couldn't imagine scenes. I'm going to show you one patient's attempt to construct a scene. So here it is. The patient was asked, imagine you're lying on a white sandy beach in a beautiful tropical bay. So there is the patient on top, P03. So he says, well, as for seeing, I can't really, apart from just sky. I can hear the sound of seagulls and of the sea. I can feel the grains of sand between my fingers. I can hear one of those ship's hooters. That's about it. And then the experimenter asks, are you actually seeing this in your mind's eye? No, the only thing I can see is blue. The experimenter says, so if you look around, what can you see? Well, really all I can see is the color of the blue sky and the white sand. The rest of it, the sounds and things, obviously I'm just hearing. Can you see anything else? No, it's like I'm kind of floating. And below that, I've just put the scene created by a control whose age, gender, IQ matched to the patient. I won't read all of this, but you'll see quickly that the control said it's very hot and the sun is beating down on me. The sand underneath me is almost unbearably hot. I can hear the sound of the small wavelets lapping on the beach. The sea is a gorgeous aquamarine color. Behind me is a row of palm trees, and so on. So there's a huge difference between these scenes. The control scene, you could quite happily step into. Who wouldn't want to be stepping into a beautiful tropical bay? But the patient scene, it's very fragmented. And indeed, they rate their scenes as spatially fragmented and lacking in coherence. And when we ask them, what do you think the problem is that you have? And here's some very insightful comments from the patients. There's no scene in front of me here. It's frustrating because I feel like there should be. I feel like I'm listening to the radio instead of watching it on the TV. I'm trying to imagine different things happening, but there's no visual scene opening out in front of me. And another patient says, it's as if I have lots of clothes to hang up in a wardrobe, but there's nothing to hang them on, and they all fall on the floor in a complete mess. Now, fMRI studies of healthy volunteers also show that the hippocampus is indeed engaged when imagining fictitious or future scenes. Now, based on these findings, we suggested that the hippocampus is needed for scene construction, that it facilitates the construction of complex spatial contexts or scenes into which the details of our experiences then get bound. And we proposed that this process underpins episodic and autobiographical memory, imagining, thinking about the future, and spatial navigation. Now, just to be clear, I'm not saying the hippocampus does all of these things alone. There are many brain regions responsible for these cognitive functions. But what I'm suggesting is, despite all the differences between these, the memory, the spatial navigation, the future thinking, and so on, they each require a special ingredient supplied by the hippocampus. And I'm suggesting that's the ability to mentally construct scenes. And if you think about it, whenever we recall the past or we're thinking about something that we're going to do in the future or we're planning a route somewhere, it invariably involves us conjuring up scenes in our mind's eye. So this may seem like heresy, but the hippocampus, which has for so long, for 60 years, been portrayed as the quintessential memory device, may not actually be about memory per se, but instead memory relies on an ingredient from the hippocampus, as do other types of cognition. Now, we recently discovered something else about scenes in the hippocampus, which I can hopefully illustrate if I have 10 willing volunteers from the audience. So what I'm going to do is show you a picture, and you can do this. Imagine you're doing this. I'm going to show you a picture. I will give you 15 seconds to look at that picture, and please know that I am going to test your memory for that picture. I have a stopwatch. No psychologist goes anywhere without one. Right, are you ready, people with clipboards? Don't do anything. You keep an eye now, make sure nobody's cheating. 15 seconds, take it in, take in as much as you can. Off you go. Okay. Please draw what you remember of that picture. Quick sketch now. Not looking for John Constable. When you're finished, can you hold your clipboard up in the air and one of the gentlemen will collect it from you. Okay? Thank you. Okay, so with the permission of the volunteers, I'm now going to share these with the audience, if that's okay. Anyone shout out if they're not happy? No? Okay, that's fine. Don't worry, we don't have anyone's names on them. Right. Are we ready for this? Okay. Now, let me zoom. Oh, hello. Right. Very good. You'd know they were bananas, right? Good, okay. Now, let's have a look here. Okay. Well, you know, but again, you'll see, it's not bad. Okay. And there we have some other ones. You capture the shape there nicely, very good. Excellent. And we'll do this quickly. Good. No, come on. People laughing weren't drawing, I notice. Yes. There we go. Lovely. Very nice. Oh, now look at this. Went very, very big on the old background there. Very good.
Very good. In fact, all of our volunteers deserve a nice round of applause. That's quite sort of slightly deconstructed one there. Okay. Now, I'm not quite sure what way to put this. Well, we get the drift. We get the drift. Very good. And again, very nice on the background there. And then we'll end with this one. Very good. Okay. Now, excellent efforts, I think you'll agree, under intense scrutiny. But I wonder, did you notice something about these drawings? There's something not quite right. I'm not going to psychoanalyze people on the basis of these. That's a whole other discourse. But if we can just go back to the slides. Are we still on them? Okay, let's go back to the drawings. See if we can identify what's not quite right. Okay, so there we have the bananas. Now, look at the bananas, people. These are big bananas. These are in-your-face bananas. These are bananas that take up much of the picture. Now, let's go back to the visualizer. These aren't big bananas. These are.
Well, that's about all the time we had for the lecture with Eleanor McGuire. She gave a lecture on neuroscience at the Royal Institute. It's about all we have time for today on today's show. We're almost at the 2 o'clock hour. And if you could email us with any comments or any show ideas or anything like that, communityliving@gmail.com, that'd be great. So until next week, we will see you all later. Bye for now. Thank you.